concerned was the liberation of Palestine and had made Islam the basis of his government. On June 6, 1982, when Ariel Sharon gave the orders to attack Lebanon, he had traveled to Iran as the bodyguard of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fazlullah. They had come to Tehran to take part in the conferences of liberation movements, but he also had a personal motivation, meeting Imam Khomeini. It was a dream that many Lebanese Muslim youths had in those days, but word of the Israeli attack on Lebanon cut the conferences short, and the participants quickly returned to Lebanon. He also went back to Lebanon after meeting with Imam Khomeini. When they arrived, the east of Beirut had been occupied and some neighborhoods were besieged by the Israeli forces. In their first attack, he and a group of his friends were able to destroy an Israeli tank and personnel carrier. Word of this attack caused the Lebanese army to open up a case against him, accusing him of fighting Israel. The case was filed under his real name, Imad Fayez Mughniyan. After the occupation, Lebanon had become another country. Palestinian fighters had been expelled, a pro-Israeli government was in place, and the massacres of Sabra and Shatila had wiped away the courage of the people to resist. The days of absolute hopelessness and fear had begun. But in the fall of that year, an important event took place in the south. It was a rainy morning when a white Peugeot 504 sped its way into the Israeli military headquarters in the city of Tyre. There was a huge explosion, and a few seconds later, the building housing the Israeli forces came crashing down on them. In one day, in one attack, more than 100 Israeli officers and soldiers were killed. The attack became the biggest anti-Israeli operation in the history of the resistance. It was after this attack which Imad, as one of the main planners, began living in hiding. The 1980s were a difficult time for Western forces in Lebanon, and the name Imad Mughniyan was word of mouth as the cause of these difficult days. Even though, during these days, he had his own independent group and organization, he used all his power to establish, shape, and strengthen Hezbollah. And his preference was to fight Israel with his own group, his own way, and with a free hand. Intelligence services from different countries were after his arrest or assassination. A ghost who would easily pass the borders of different countries, but they were never able to pinpoint his location. He had dedicated his life to the struggle with Israel. When Sayed Hassan Nasrallah became Secretary General, Imad became the leader of Hezbollah's intelligence apparatus and used all his experience for Hezbollah to have the upper hand when it came to the information warfare with Israel. This upper hand proved itself with the successful assassinations of Israeli commanders and the leaders of the Lahad Army. But the more significant event happened in 1997, when he was able to decode the imagery of Israeli drones, and with that he was able to cause the defeat of the Israeli Special Forces unit in Ansariya village. The Ansariya operation was the first time in Israeli history that its Special Forces unit had been defeated. A year after the Ansariya operation, Haj Imad became Sayed Nasrallah's jihadi deputy and chose the name Haj Radwan for himself. While maintaining his previous role in the intelligence apparatus, he also took over command of Hezbollah's military. It didn't take long before operations against Israel became more extensive and goal-oriented. He used the years of experience he had in the intelligence fight against Israel in military operations. He was a commander who would count on all financial and material facilities, but would never solely rely on them. Later, Israel withdrew from Lebanese soil. This was the first time that Israel was forced to leave the areas it had occupied because of resistance operations. And again, Haj Radwan's name was registered as a leading role in Israel's historic withdrawal. But the story didn't end there. There were still many Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails, something Hezbollah could not ignore. Even though taking Israeli hostages was difficult and impossible, it seemed to be the only way to get the prisoners released. Haj Radwan was the commander of this impossible mission in the Sheb'a farms. It was after this operation that negotiations to exchange prisoners sped up. 4 years of indirect negotiations between Hezbollah and Israel came to fruition on Thursday, January 29, 2004. 439 prisoners and 59 martyrs were exchanged with a Mossad officer and the bodies of three Israeli soldiers. This left only one Lebanese prisoner in Israeli custody. This was why Hezbollah's Secretary General promised more hostage takings in the ceremony to welcome the prisoners. It was obvious that he was counting on the capability and power of a commander who had spent his entire life fighting Israel. Haj Radwan had to carry out the operation at a time when the enemy had put its forces on total standby. He chose an elite group of Hezbollah's best forces and held difficult and clear-cut training sessions for them. He was present for the trainings because he wanted to personally make sure that the operation would succeed. On the morning of July the 12th, 2006, Hezbollah forces were able to pass through the border barriers and take two Israeli soldiers hostage. Unprecedented event, the Israeli Prime Minister ordered attacks on Lebanon. Israeli fighter jets bombed Lebanese cities and villages from the south to the north. Then, by relying on their spies, they targeted Hezbollah's missile launch pads, not knowing that they had once again been tricked and fallen in the trap of Haj Radwan. In the previous years, he had allowed Israel to identify centers where Hezbollah had its missiles so that Israeli intelligence capabilities would focus on these unreal targets. The general staff of the Israeli military directly informed the prime minister of the destruction of these targets and congratulated him on winning the war. But exactly the next day, more than 100 missiles were launched at Israeli settlements. After that, and for weeks, the Israeli Air Force was bombing Lebanon indiscriminately, only with the hope of destroying Hezbollah's launch pads. And on the other side, Hezbollah missiles were targeting occupied Palestine, including Haifa. This caused the commander of the Israeli forces to decide to launch a ground attack on Lebanon by counting on their Merkava tanks. But Hajj Radwan and the other resistance commanders had already predicted the attack. Hezbollah fighters used Hornet missiles and roadside bombs to block the path of the Israeli attack. In the end, after 33 days, the Israelis gave in to a ceasefire without being able to get their hostages back or destroying Hezbollah's launch pads. And this was how the longest war Israel had fought ended in its defeat. Two years after the 33-day war, the Israelis were forced to release Samir Qantar and other prisoners that Hezbollah wanted. Hajj Radwan was not present on that day, but he had planned the hostage-taking operation in such a way that the Israelis were not able to know whether their hostages were dead or alive, even after he was gone. On July the 16th, 2008, the prisoner exchange deal was implemented, an operation which was adorned by the name of martyr Hajj Radwan, a man whose name is registered in history alongside Israel's greatest defeats.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr al-Din, Muhammad il-Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about the unlawful gains according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Tawhid, is it permissible to build a complex containing a prison and a police station for the use of a tyrannical government? And is it permissible to work in such a project, like to find a job as a prison ward, mm-hmm. or even a civil engineer who helps building such a place, you know, like a police station or a prison for such government?
Yes, you're right. Well, there's no objection to construct such a complex, provided that it's not intended for unjust practices, you know, or for imprisonment of, let's say, innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the constructor does not maintain that the complex is exposed to such uses, you know.
Yes.
If a person is certain, or if someone is cocksure that the facility is going to be used to imprison or jail religious scholars, innocent people, and to torture these people, of course, it's not permissible for such a person to build such a facility. In case a person have no idea whatsoever that the facility that he's going to build will be used for such purposes, of course, there will be no objection to him, and the constructor can receive the wages for his work,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
I see. Somebody asked this question, Sheikh Javi, that he involves in presenting a show of bullfights. You know, in some countries, it's pretty
like
much
Spain,
common.
For example.
Yeah, or rooster fight, for example.
Yeah.
In some of the Eastern countries, if I'm not mistaken. For those interested in watching it for a fee that they pay as a gift, for example, is such work in and of itself permissible according to Ayatollah Khamenei?
Well, it is problematic. You know, this work is, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, objectionable. You know, it's a matter of objection. Let's put it otherwise. According to Islamic Sharia, His Eminence says that there is objection in presenting such a show, a bullfight, or let's say a dog fight, a rooster fight. You know, I have myself seen such bullfights or dog fight. You know, it is abominable. You know,
yes.
From the viewpoint of an ordinary person, it is abominable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that it is a matter of objection, you know.
You mean it's controversial?
It's controversial, you know. The religious authorities, generally speaking, do not allow such a fight to take place, you know. And even to get involved in presenting such a show and also receiving wages for the show. You know, His Eminence says that receiving presents from the viewers, from the onlookers, and other people who come to watch the fight does no harm. You know, he says that no problem. There is no problem in receiving there is no harm in receiving the gifts from people if they are giving those gifts willingly. Mm-hmm. With their own consent.
I see.
With their own consent. But generally speaking, there is objection to having this show or holding this bullfight or dog fight, you know, because the animals actually end up killing each other.
Exactly.
The dog, they actually end
Not
up...
Not to mention the animals' rights activists and...
Definitely.
Yeah.
And it looks very much obscene.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our discussion on these questions according to Ayatollah Khan.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. My guest speaker is still Sheikh Javed. In this program, we are still dealing with some of the religious questions according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. And I wanted to ask you, Sheikh Javed, what is the ruling on the manufacture, sale, purchase, and use of fireworks and explosive materials? Irrespective of whether or not they are of the type that may cause annoyance or even harm to people?
Well, it's not permissible if they pose harm and annoyance to others, or actually indulging in them is regarded as a kind of wastefulness and squandering, you know. If it amounts to squandering wealth, to wastefulness, it is forbidden. And if it poses harm or if it causes damage to public property, like I have seen myself, some explosives, firecrackers or fireworks burn property and cars and other things. And even some of them cause injuries.
Yes,
you know?
It plays havoc.
Yes.
Ayatollah
Khamenei says that it's not permissible if such consequences are there, if it poses harm or if it causes annoyance, and otherwise, if you burn fireworks, if you set off fireworks in an open space where there is no property, let's like in a wilderness, in an open area where there are no people, no property to be damaged, okay, then there's no problem.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Javed, some women, you know, may find their work in beauty shops.
Sure.
All right. provide an income for the family or to add an income to the family. Does this not lead to immorality, which in turn is bound to undermine the chastity of the Islamic society?
Well, from what you asked, I understand that if, let's say, working in beauty shops might lead to some kind of indecency or, let's say, some kind of immorality, corruption or evil or something like that, yes? Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that there's no objection to working in making up ladies, making up brides, you know?
Yes.
And beautifying women, there's no problem. And of course, it's not objectionable. It's not a matter of ishkar or problem or objection to get paid for the work you do, for the services you offer, because actually some brides, some ladies do want to get themselves made up, to beautify themselves, to use adornments, you know, and to beautify themselves. Islam is not opposed to beautifying yourself or to using makeup, as long as you observe the Shari limits. For example, if a woman makes herself up or wears makeup for her husband or for, let's say, for a gathering of women, and she does not reveal her beautification or adornment or jewelry or ornaments or things like that to non-mahram or to strangers, of course there's no objection to such a woman.
I see.
And of course, getting paid as a woman who works in a beauty parlor is not haram either.
I see. What about the money earned by dealers and go-betweens? Is it permissible for the intermediaries or facilitators of businesses and work between the builders and the owners, for example, to get paid for their services?
That's a good question. There's no problem in getting paid for halal work, of course. You know, there's no objection, you see, to work as an intermediary between, let's say, between a constructor or a worker or
this
a
buyer. This is what the dealers do.
Yeah, of course, that's what the dealers or property dealers do.
Yes.
So Ayatollah Khamenei says that there's no problem in getting paid for such a halal work.
And probably it is permissible to get commission, right?
Commission, of course.
Yes,
commission.
Which is pretty much common among the real estate agencies.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The joint military maneuvers that are underway in the Red Sea region involving the UAE, Bahrain, the US, and the illegal Zionist entity have been aptly called a dagger in the heart of Al-Quds, Palestine, and all the nations of the region. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, The Arab-Israeli Dagger Aimed at the Heart of Islam. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The joint military maneuvers that are underway in the Red Sea region involving the UAE, Bahrain, the US, and the illegal Zionist entity have been aptly called a dagger in the heart of Al-Quds, Palestine, and all the nations of the region. According to a senior official of Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, these nefarious naval exercises encourages the Zionist enemy to carry out further acts of aggression against Lebanon and Palestine, and is a stain of shame on the foreheads of the leaders of the normalization with the Zionist regime. Hujjatul Islam Nabil Gauk was not exaggerating. He was simply pointing to facts by noting the bragging to reporters of an Israeli naval that such military cooperation under U.S. auspices could help counter Iran in the region. What has the Islamic Republic of Iran done to become the target of the U.S. and its accomplices in the region, the ruthless and unrepresentative Arab regimes, and the Zionists? Nothing wrong except calling on regional countries to rid the region of extra-regional forces in order to establish sustainable security cooperation and coordination. As a matter of fact, the Arab-Israelite alliance, whether covert or overt, is not a new phenomenon resulting from the so-called Abraham Accord of the U.S. that emboldened the UAE and Bahrain to establish open diplomatic ties and exchange ambassadors after funding Takfiri terrorists to destabilize Syria, branding Lebanon's Hezbollah as terrorists, backstopping Palestinian Muslims, and vilifying the Islamic Iran for its selfless efforts to foster Islamic unity for the cherished goal of liberating Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. In the light of historical realities, this unholy alliance has always been a dagger aimed at the heart of Islam and Muslims ever since the time of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had blunted this dagger by expelling from Medina the treacherous Israelite tribes of Banu Nadir and Banu Qunayqa, which then ganged up with the pagan Arabs to launch the abortive battle of the Confederates. He then broke the Arab-Israeli alliance into pieces during the famous campaign of Khaybar, thanks to the flashing blade of his cousin, son-in-law, and vicegerent Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. In due course, the Israelite tribes of Arabia and the die-hard pagan Arabs felt no other choice other than paying lip service to Islam, but they never became true Muslims and turned out to be hypocrites, harboring malice deep down in their hearts against the solidarity of the Ummah. With the illegitimate birth of Israel on Palestinian soil in 1948, when several Arab Muslim countries started their joint campaign to nip the Zionists in the bud, the hypocrite-serving Anglo-American imperialist interest schemed to turn the tide of the war from victory into defeat, a scenario that was repeated in 1967 and 1973 before reaching climax in 1978 at Camp David, U.S., with Anwar Sadat's scandalous accord. The grand victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 and the dynamic measures of Imam Khomeini in designating the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as Islamic Unity Week, and the last Friday of the month of Ramadan as Quds International Day for mobilizing world Muslims for the campaign to liberate Palestine horrified the hypocrites, who now clung more firmly to U.S. apron and under its cover to the Israeli regime. As Iran braved the illegal American sanctions to emerge as the paramount power in the region by working closely with like-minded independent forces in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Yemen, and elsewhere, the hitherto covert Arab-Israeli alliance was encouraged by Godfather U.S. to come out into the open. It is now the major threat to the security of independent countries of the region, especially Syria and Iraq, which have defeated a devilish plot by the Americans, the Zionists, and the Arab reactionaries. It is, however, not invincible, as the conspirators make it out to be. It could be defeated provided the heads of the countries of the region come to their senses and realize the avowed enmity of the Israelites against Islam and the hypocrisy of their allies, the ruthless and unrepresentative regimes of the Persian Gulf.
Qamus al-Rijal starts with an introduction, and in this introduction there are 28 chapters in which different ideas that late Allama Tustari had in Ilm al-Rijal are mentioned in this introduction.
Allama Shushtari, since he was really interested in this field of study, when he was reading the book Tanqih al-Maqal, he had his specific comments on the views of Allama Mamaqani, the author of the book and Tanqih al-Maqal. Ourselves we strayed from an mu'annim. Surely
we've wronged ourselves. What will we say? Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher. Ya mu'allim, peace be upon you. Truly you are our teacher. Ooh.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and scholars all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah to you and to your dear listeners.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding figure who was one of the contemporary Shia Rijal scholars. Of course, we will talk what is Rijal and what is this field of study. He is no one but Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you, Muhammad Taghi Shushtari and his early life. What information do we have about him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari is born to a family of knowledge, and he is born in Najaf in 1903 and then moved to Iran when he was 7 years old. But after he studied for some years in Iran in opposition to the law of Kashf Hijab being issued by Reza Shah.
Yes.
Actually, the first Pahlavi Shah of Iran being under the dominance of yes. British Empire.
You mean forced unveiling of the women in Iran on that time by the order?
Yes, it was issued.
Yes.
Okay, in opposition to this movement, he left Iran and went back to Atabat Aliyat, stayed there for 7 years or 6 years, as he mentions in his biography. And when he was there, he started offering his outstanding work, Qamus al-Rijal. Mm-hmm. And yes. after that, he went back to Iran and stayed in Shushtar.
Yes.
This is very important to pay attention to. He was a really great scholar, but he stayed in Shushtar, although we know we had a very great scholars
yes.
coming from Shushtar, naming Sheikh Ansari. Every student of seminary school yes. Is familiar with the personality of Sheikh Ansari. He belongs to the city of Shushtar.
Sheikh al-Akbar, you mean? Sheikh Ansari.
Sheikh al-A'zam.
A'zam or Akbar, yes, that's right. Yes. And where is Shushtar?
Shushtar is a north city of the province of Khuzestan.
Uh-huh. It's in the southern Iran.
Yes.
So it is not originally belonging to any famous Hausa or something, no? I mean, it is not famous like Qom, Mashhad, or
definitely.
Najaf.
Okay. Yeah, that is yeah. just, you can give it a try. You ask the students of Hausa, just name some well-known cities of the knowledge mm-hmm. of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
First, they may call Qom or Najaf, and they may refer to Mashhad, yes. even Isfahan.
Yes.
But barely they may consider Shushtar mm-hmm. as one of the cities of knowledge of Ahlul Bayt.
That's right.
So I was just mentioning this point that out of having a very simple life, avoiding fame, he stayed in Shushtar until the end of his life. Mm-hmm. He actually was residing in Shushtar, although he had some trips and going to Iraq, coming to Qom and other cities and staying for a short period of time. But mainly he resided in Shushtar, and finally he passed away there in year 1995 and buried in Shushtar.
That's all right.
Yeah.
You know, in the past and also in the present time, some of the ulama who are studying in the city of Najaf, Qom or Mashhad, when they are done and they receive, we can say, the permission of Ijtihad, they get back to their homeland because they believe that we have to be useful for the, we can say, the people of that region. Although it must be a village or a very small town in Iran or in Iraq or any part of the Muslim land, they get back over there and are the source of benefits, you know, for the people over there. This is, I think, a really beautiful habit that some of the ulama, especially in the past generation, it was more than now. We can say the people got back to their homeland and has been over there preaching Islam, answering the religious questions of the people over there, having a very simple life. And the people around could see an alim living among them, okay? Or being busy with a scholar life in the same city that he was born. This is, I think, really appreciable
by the side of some of the scholars, including Muhammad Taghi Shushtari. Okay, Sheikh Ziyaniyal, let's get to you, brother. What other information do we have about the scholarly life and the education of Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The late Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, or At-Tustari, is a well-known figure among Islamic scholars that dedicated his life for different, you know, well-known works like Qamus al-Rijal and also like the book Bahj al-Sabaqa fi Sharh Nahj al-Balagha, that we may discuss about these works inshallah later. You know, he was amongst those figures that beside studying and compiling books, as you mentioned, he was living amongst people.
Yes.
And he decided to settle in Shushtar. And this is, as you mentioned, was a seera of ulama, of scholars. For example, Marhum Sheikh Abdul Karim Al-Ha'iri,
yes,
when he returned to Iran, he didn't move to Qom.
Yes.
He went to Iraq and yes, settled there.
Yes.
And as a result of the invitation of the scholars of Qom, he decided to come to Qom. Or late Marhum Ayatollah Burujerdi Rahmatullah Alayhi, yes, he himself didn't come to Qom directly from Najaf. As a result of the invitation of the scholars in Qom, he decided to come to Qom.
Also the late Mazandarani, I think, in the northern Iran, who
yeah, many different
yeah, at the
scholars.
Time of Sheikh Ansari, because when they referred to Sheikh Ansari to select him as the Zaim of Hawza of Najaf, they said refer to that man, okay?
Yeah.
But that man was living in Iran, in the northern part of Iran, in the villages, but higher in education, as Sheikh Ansari himself believed.
Yeah.
This was, as I said, a very beautiful custom and habit, mind you.
And late Marhum Tostari had really a humble life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was avoiding to be in a materialistic life, as
yes,
the seat of scholars and ulama is like this. For example, I quote from some of the scholars that I have heard from them that when he wanted to publish his books, he used to come to Tehran or Qom to visit some scholars. And he had some, you know, papers with himself,
yes,
you know, a bunch of papers, and he was telling them, okay, this is my new works. You search and take a look on it,
yes,
and maybe it's useful. If
yes,
you find it useful, you may publish it.
Okay.
So he was not, you know, counting himself as a noble scholar that
yes,
every person must refer to.
Yes.
And he, you know, himself was trying to broadcast the call of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu
wassalam
amongst Muslims.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, besides having, you know, this type of life, after his demise even, people are, you know, because they were familiar with his personality. Nowadays, his tomb in Shushtar is a place that people are gathering in the day of Ashura to have a procession and
yes,
to have the demonstration there. And you know that he wrote in his will that all of his books are given to the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam, but these books must not, you know, taken out from his house. So now that house is its building and all, you know, the furniture of the house are belonging to the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam, but it's a library.
That's all right.
And museum. People are referring to that library. It's, you know, useful for them.
Okay.
And, you know, even after his life, his house and his properties are benefiting people.
That's all right.
Shushtar.
Sheikh Mahtabi, Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, or as is known of Allama, Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, is known because of his work in the field of Rijal. Okay. Some of our dear listeners might not be familiar with this field of study. What does it mean by Rijal, and what is it concerned about?
This is a very good question. Elmur Rijal, or if we wanted to translate it into English, we have to say the science of narrators,
mm-hmm,
is considered out of one of the very important knowledges that, or sciences that every student of, or every mujtahid is relying on in order to differentiate or distinguish between the trustworthy narration and fabricated narrations.
Definitely.
So it's got a very high position in terms of reaching the level of ijtihad. And it can support all Muslim or all believers in order to defend from their religion, because sometimes we might be accused of holding faith into the religion that has been transmitted through narrators that we have no knowledge about the their level of knowledge, their authenticity.
Yes.
So through science of narrators or ilmur rijal, we are presenting the process in which mujtahid or the scholar can distinguish between the fake narrations, fabricated narrations, and genuine one.
So the rijal here means the narrator of ahadith, is it?
Yes, it concerns with biography and everything which is related to the personality of narrators of ahadith or narrations.
Okay.
So this is a very important thing that our audience must take into consideration before we deal with this personality.
That's all right. So different scholars like Muhammad Taghi Shushtari tried in order to differentiate or distinguish between authentic and the non-authentic narrators of ahadith, is it?
It's better to say one of his works is dedicated to this,
to this
field of study.
But he's known with this work, I mean, Qamus al-Rijal.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. He had this expertise to differentiate between the different narrators.
Right.
Yes.
Any other benefit for the students who are interested in Rijal, Sheikh Ziyaniya? Do you think that it is a must for the Islamic students of the houses to be familiar with this field of study? Do you think it's useful for them?
For sure. You know, if a person wants to get benefit from the Islamic resources, he needs to get benefit from the reliable ones.
Yes.
And authentic ones. So if you want to use the authentic resources, you need to know them. And how we can know these resources? Through ilm al-rijal. So if you want to, for example, in ilm al-fiqh, you want to give fatwa in accordance with riwayat, you need to know the narrators and to distinguish and distinct between the authentic one and non-authentic ones. So ilm al-rijal is useful in this regard. And also, if even in history,
that's right,
ilm al-rijal is useful. So you may get, you know, you may distinct between the books and the writers that have compiled, you know, weak riwayat and narrations, and those ones who have compiled and, you know, gathered authentic ones.
That's right.
So it's a tool for a scholar who wants to do research regarding Islamic studies.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyaniya. And Sheikh Mahdavi, and finally, Allama Shushtari passed away in 1416, according to the Hijra calendar, 19th day of the month of Zulhijjah. You know, and he was, as Sheikh Mahdavi also said, he was buried in the city of Shushtar, the place that he belonged to. His library is over there. His tomb is over there. He lived for 96 years, a very fruitful life, and you know, compiled one of the most outstanding work in the field of Rijal study, that is Qamus al-Rijal. We will talk about Qamus al-Rijal in our upcoming session of the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you, Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdavi.
You're most welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Do not forget to visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.